As above, so below.
Welcome to Connecting with Coincidence. I am your host, Bernard Beitman, MD. I'm a psychiatrist. I study meaningful coincidences. And I have a book called Meaningful Coincidences, which describes how synchronicity and serendipity may operate, how to explain them and what you can do with them. And it's a guidebook for organizing what has been a confusing field for a lot of people. And I hope you can use it to organize your own meaningful coincidence stories and experiences. And the story I'm going to tell you today, I think might be one that stretches your mind a little bit, because it's one of my favorite kind of coincidences. It's a coincidence about coincidence, a coincidence about a coincidence. I call it a meta coincidence, coincidence about a coincidence. The story involves three guests that have been on my podcast before, Sheila, Josh, and Anna. Sheila and Anna, I thought, knew each other. They both are psychiatrists in Connecticut. Josh didn't know either one of them. I knew him from Charlottesville, Virginia, where he used to live, and now he mostly lives in LA. He's the guy who moves around a bit and loves to dance. Well, as usual, I was sending Sheila the link to the YouTube publication of my interview with her, and I decided to send a copy to Anna, and it was one of those, why not, kind of in the middle of the late night, and I just kind of just, one of those urges. And those urges are really important for each of you to keep in mind, because they often lead you to really cool stuff. It's your intuition trying to get you to do something, but you still have to decide. But I didn't know that. I was ready to go to bed, so I put it out there. This small nudge is fundamental to helping create meaningful coincidences. So right after I sent this email out to Sheila and Anna, I got this text message back from Anna. She says, "I'm at a dance in Los Angeles, but you're in New Haven, but I'm in a dance in Los Angeles, and I'm talking to Josh," whom she'd never met until this dance in LA. And we began talking about synchronicity, and we both said, "Oh, Bernie knows a lot about synchronicity. And do you know Bernie?" And yeah, they both know me. And they both got excited that they both happened coincidentally to run into each other at a dance, and they were starting to talk about me. Well, at the moment they were talking about me, they got the email from me, or Anna did, that I was for me about Sheila. And that was a coincidence about a coincidence. They came together coincidentally somehow, and then right when they're talking about me, I interject myself with that nudge and say, "Hey, I'm here too. And I'm listening to you without knowing I'm listening to you. How does that work? I don't know. But part of the fun of all this is figuring out how this works. And there's nobody that I have met in all these interviews and books that I've read about coincidences who is figuring out how things work than our guest today, Jude Kuravan. She knows how the universe works, not knows, but she has an excellent idea about how everything is connected. You know, we talk about how things are connected. She tells us about not the Big Bang, but the Big Breath, or how it condensed high energy information something that didn't blow up, but breathed out. And with through the many steps she describes in her book, The Story of Gaia, Gaia being another name for Earth, she describes how everything started with connection and still is. And if you're willing to go through a lot of the science of this, and there is a lot of science, you get a sense of the universe not being this abstract, concrete void of a lot of stuff, planets and asteroids and galaxies and stuff out there and constellations, but a living, breathing entity. And from that, you'll get a sense of how we are all connected in a way that you probably would not have understood before if you go through what Jude talks about. Well, she's a cosmologist, a futurist, a planetary healer, which is what I'm trying to do with meaningful coincidences, an author, a member of Evolutionary Leaders Circle, and previously one of the most senior international What Business Women in UK. I mean, what's all this with business and master's degrees in physics from Oxford, specializing in quantum physics and cosmology, a PhD in archaeology, researching ancient cosmologies. She's traveled over 80 countries, worked with wisdom keepers from many traditions, is a lifelong researcher in one of my favorite phrases, the nature of reality, because I use meaningful coincidences to try to figure out what's going on around here. That's my little probe into how things work. She's the author of seven books, one of them, The Cosmic Hologram from 2017. And the book I'm referring to is The Story of Gaia. This how we all got here. In 2017, she founded the Whole World View, and I recommend you go to that website to see how she is conceptualizing in a practical way what's coming out of the work that's coming through her. Because of all the things that I just described about Jude, planetary healer is the most important practical thing that she is doing. She's written a lot, she knows a lot, but helping us heal the planet, which is helping us heal ourselves, which helping us find our way together, and how we're together is fundamental to what we need to do. And Jude is here doing it. And again, she'll not claim much responsibility for it. She has more responsibility that she wants to take, in my humble opinion, but it comes through her. So I introduce to you Jude Kuravan. And Jude, it's a pleasure to look at the face behind the brain that transmuted the information that got to my head, and now to look at you. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Bernard. And I have to say, when you were describing everything, and you said, my goodness, it's been a scenic route, as they say. The journey has been a scenic route.
That's a good way of saying it. It's been a scenic route. 80 countries, just to be literal about it, but also intellectually and visionary wise, the imagination that it took to write what you wrote. Also was a must have been a lot of fun going from the big breath to asteroids. And my favorite thing is chlorophyll. I've told you that. I've asked you that a few, about that chlorophyll. Well, we might get around to those chloroplasts one of these days, but they're a miracle to me because without them I wouldn't be having breakfast. So there's a lot more to it than that too. So let's start over. If you don't mind, I'd like you to comment on that story that I just told at the beginning about the two people and then my email coming into that. What do you think of that one?
Well, I love it. I love synchronicities. For me, they're my way showers. And when I respond to those meaningful coincidences, and don't ignore them or push them to one side. They've always led me, you know, in an incredible way. And I love what you said about nudge, because often they're sort of preset with a little nudge, like you thought when you'd already sent the email, oh, I'll send it on to Anna. It was that nudge that you listened to that actually then brought the coincidence of coincidences into play. And that's very much been my experience. And I guess having experienced, you know, nudges and intuitive insights all my life, and far more, in fact, than those, and showing up and following synchronicities or meaningful coincidences in my journey, what I've loved to do is, as you mentioned, sort of see what the sense of that is. How does that hang together? Because mainstream science tells us that synchronicities, meaningful coincidences, don't exist. They really poo-poo, you know, our intuitive abilities. They don't have a place in the model of materialism and separation for what I call supernormal phenomena, not paranormal, not supernatural, but telepathic and, you know, attributes. What I'm writing about, based on the evidence, is showing that these are all natural attributes. They're all natural parts to our being human in this incredible universe.
Yes. Yes, they're all part. And what I, in my phrase, I put it as, I am normalizing meaningful coincidences.
Yeah, absolutely. And
it, well, we get to have this funny contradiction of weird stuff is common.
I love it. There's an old English term, you know, when we say, this is weird. The old English is weird, W-Y-R-D, and it's the path of wisdom. So when somebody says, this is weird, I say, yes, it is, because it's the path of wisdom.
Passive wisdom?
No, the path of wisdom.
The path of wisdom.
Yeah.
The path of wisdom.
Yes, weird was wise in old English.
I love how words get their opposites. They often get to their opposites. The name of the survey that I put together to establish in the science, just as a scientist trying to say, okay, this stuff happens, can I get some numbers for it? I put it together with some researchers, and I called it the Weird Coincidence Survey. So now I've even got a better reason for calling it the Wise Coincidence Survey.
Absolutely.
That's good. So there's so much that I want to be able to ask you, but let's start with one of your stories, one of your weird coincidences that illustrates for you how this weirdness is a path of wisdom.
Well, I'm the daughter and granddaughter of coal miners in the north of England. Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in a community that was very well grounded. And yet,
that's literal.
That is so literal. But I was having experiences of intuitive insights and telepathic connections and precognitive dreams and out-of-body experiences from the age of four. And I never shared those with my family. Not that my mum would have had any issue with that. She loved me unconditionally. But, you know, I wasn't scared of telling anybody. It just didn't occur to me. But my brother and I are very different people, and we adore each other. But he is very much of this call a spade, and this is solid and all the rest of it, where I was experiencing reality in very different ways. So this story is from a few years ago, and he's always been, you know, so supportive of me. Whether he's understood what I do or not, he's been incredibly supportive of me, and vice versa. But we went to a bookstore. I was up there on a visit because I live about 200 miles away. I was up there on a visit and wanted to get a gift for my niece our niece. And so we went to a bookstore. And when we went in, it's a really lovely bookstore. But I wandered around and wandered around, and him and books aren't the best friends. he's incredibly practical, but he doesn't read a lot. Anyway, I went and tried to find a book that I thought, you know, our relative would be interested in. And I went to a particular bookshelf and I took out the book that I thought she might like. And behind that book on the same shelf was one of my earlier books, right? Of all the bookstore. Yeah. And so I called him over and I said, "What do you think of that?" And he went, "Yeah." Not much to see here. So that was very synchronous for me. And it also offered him an opportunity to see a meaningful coincidence in this. Because I said, "Look, see all these books in the bookstore. I take this one out of maybe, I don't know, 10,000, and my book's behind it, you know. Don't you think that's meaningful?" And it was really sweet because we went back home and had a cup of tea and I could see a little chink, a little chink in the possibility of the meaningful nature of it. And I love that because I was there when that chink happened for him. And I don't know how far he'll go down that journey, but I do know that over these years since, he really has become more open to possibilities. And I just sense back into that moment, you know, in that bookstore when other possibilities began to speak to him.
Well, you're able to think metaphorically as well. And what you just described there is what I am trying to do. And I think you are trying to do is to be able to put chinks in people's belief systems that allow them to open up to the nature of reality that you have experienced, which I also know about and have experienced, this weird stuff out there that's the path of wisdom. That how are we going to help people do that in an accelerated way as we warm this planet too much?
I mean, that's the fundamental question, isn't it? And to respond to that, you know, you said, you talked about planetary healing earlier, and I do feel, and this isn't a blame game or a shame game at all, but the last few hundred years, and especially the last 100 years or so, we've really moved into a collective worldview of separation and materialism that's been supported essentially by 19th century science, actually, rather than 20th century. But in the 19th century, the worldview of science was very mechanistic. It was very much that the whole world is a cogs in a machine. Yeah.
Newton did it to us. Yes.
Well, he started that journey, but, you know, there are a lot of folks on that journey taking that forward. But of course, it also played into the social structures that were coming out of the Industrial Revolution. Your hierarchies, literally cogs in an industrial machine.
Yeah.
So that the structures that came forward in the 19th century were very much about mechanisms and cogs and human beings being cogs in a materialistic, mechanistic machine. So when 20th century science, the revolutions of quantum physics and relativity physics actually gave us clues to something deeper, that mechanistic worldview and the structures around it, whether it be companies, governments, healthcare, education, we're all still in that very mechanistic perspective. And that's continued. So the last 100 years with science primarily has been progress through technology rather than progress at the really foundations of the nature of reality. But like all good stories and like all good scientific revolutions, that era now is coming to another level of profound revolution and doing so from the scientific discoveries literally of the last few years. So those two books, The Cosmic Hologram and The Story of Gaia, I could not have written with all my experiences. I could not have written until 2017 for The Cosmic Hologram and late last year for The Story of Gaia, because the evidence to ground, to frame, to base what I share was not there. And the reason I feel now very excited about these chinks is the evidence is shaking that edifice, that old material site, you know, that old worldview of materialism and separation. And it's revealing, it's turning it on its head. It's turning it on its head. And what it's doing is far more important than science itself, because it's really who we are. And its evidence is being shown at all scales of existence, from the tiniest to the whole universe, but at the level of our everyday lives. And this is, we get into this, obviously, I hope we do. It's showing that those are the same patterns that pervade our collective behaviors as pervade the natural world. It's showing that literally, and this is transformational, it seems to me, that mind and consciousness aren't something we have. They're literally what we and the whole world are. And they're showing us, they're revealing to us a universe which meaningfully exists and purposefully evolves as a wholeness, as a unified entity. And I'm saying that because it's not just an aspiration or a hope. It's that this is what the evidence is revealing, that unity is our existential reality. And so what you're doing has an incredibly great, empowering, natural home within this framework, which is both new, but it's also ancient. This is the basis for so many wisdom teachings throughout the ages. And now leading edge science is converging with these.
Yeah. I was just entranced by what you were saying. And so I'm a little bit slowed down in responding, because you, not just through your words, but I can sometimes climb up through the words into somebody's mind. And that's what I was doing with what you were saying, and being able to experience your experience of this oneness. There's a phrase that in Judaism, God is one. And that's not just in Judaism, it's a lot of other places, but that's where I first really heard it said all over and over again. And this oneness has been a mystery, because we don't know what that means. But what you've done is create the way you talk about that. One of my favorite things is dark matter, just because I like it. I mean, it's dark that we can't see it, but it sure is doing something. And that dark matter creates a scaffold for everything to be able to hang around on. It's a way to organize, to have a place to stand, so you don't kind of move around all over the place. Dark matter holds it together, so that the constellations don't fly apart and the Earth doesn't fly off someplace else and the galaxies stay kind of relatively together. Dark matter is what holds it together while the universe is expanding. And so it's a play against of the expanding universe. Okay, that I like scaffolding, because in my small way of thinking about things, and I don't have the perspective you have as a cosmologist directly. I mean, I have it kind of more now that I've seen your book and have listened to you. But I'm very earthbound in the way I'm thinking about things, because the problems are right here. Sure. And it has to do with my being a physician, being a psychiatrist, and having this terrible need to help. I don't know, it's like, what's with this needing to help all the time thing? It gets me in trouble sometimes. I get too helpful. And there is a limit to how much helpfulness one should have and whom one should help. And I have to learn that. And I learned that recently really very well. But we're here to help, and so are you. And you have a desire to help heal the planet. And I have it to heal the planet in a way that I can offer, And we all we have these different ways of offering how to heal the planet. And I think what your One World idea is doing is trying to bring them together. And so am I. But I'm starting with almost like a big breath. It's like I'm starting with the nucleus of an idea of synchronicity, taking it from Jung, and trying to be able to have this expand out into human consciousness. And I would like to have synchronicity, meaningful coincidences, be part of the way human beings think about themselves and think about each other and think about our relationships with each other. That's my vision. I got a nose in my face. That's my vision. That's what I do. And I'm trying to do that. And I have a pathway to be able to try to do that. And what I wanted to talk with you about particularly is the scaffolding idea, as you see it in the universe, which I now can do because of what you've written, and my affinity for dark energy, put them together. But I like to conceptualize the possibility of a mental atmosphere that we around Earth, like our breathing atmosphere, like our air atmosphere, in which we breathe out carbon dioxide, we breathe in oxygen. I think we breathe out ideas and information and emotion, and we breathe in ideas and information. So when you say things are coming through you, where are they coming? Well, part of the place they're coming through is through the psychosphere, as I call it. And this psychosphere is being provided a scaffolding, I think, by the internet. The internet is connecting us all in this technological way, but it's also allowing other ideas like telepathy and clairvoyance to take place the same way talking on a telephone or talking the way we are, or clairvoyance looking at you. I can see you now. This technology is, we can do that without the technology itself, because we have the technology in ourselves to be able to discover that. In other words, it's techno mimicry, but the technology is mimicking our own potential. So what do you think? And one more point, simultaneous independent discoveries is an example of ideas floating around in the psychosphere, where people come up with the same idea, having very little relationship, if none, with each other. Calculus being one, the telephone being another. There's hundreds of them that are in world history. So that I'm trying to map as well as I can in talking with you this scaffoldingly increasing psychosphere, and how it shows methods by which we are interconnected.
Great, absolutely. And I love that, you know, our technosphere is a predisposition in a way for us to move to what perhaps Teilhard de Chardin called the newer sphere.
Yeah, that's the same idea.
Planetary consciousness. So yeah. we're sort of being predisposed to hopefully that next step, awakening and expanding our awareness into that deeper level of remembered interconnectedness. But for me, I guess, where I can serve and contribute is actually bringing the evidence together and a framework together that actually where all of this is naturally manifested, where it's not either peripheralized because there isn't any notion in the worldview, the concept, but that it is natural. So for example, so let me, if I might, just spend a few minutes just perhaps sharing these basic premises of a universe that meaningfully exists and purposefully evolves as a what's called a non-locally unified entity.
Go ahead, please.
Okay, let's go for it. We're back 13.8 billion years, as you mentioned, to the very first moment of our universe, of space and time and energy and matter, both dark and dark matter, dark energy, and visible energy matter, but space and time itself. And that first moment was minute. I mean, Fred Hoyle, the British astronomer called it the Big Bang, quite in a derogative way.
Yeah, because
he didn't like the idea at all. But the evidence is very much now of the view that, yes, indeed, our universe began 13.8 billion years ago in its tiniest scale. So it wasn't big, we know that. But the word bang connotates an explosion, a chaos. And we now know that the beginning of our universe was incredibly fine-tuned and ordered. And so I have renamed that, not as a single one-off event, but the first moment of an ongoing big breath, as you mentioned. So ever since that first moment, space has expanded and time has flowed from the past to the present. And we're essentially now on the bow wave in this present moment of our universe's continuing evolutionary journey from simplicity to ever greater levels of complexity. Now, within space-time, nothing can go faster than the speed limit of light, the speed of light. That's the speed limit. That's the cosmic speed cop. No signal can go faster than the speed of light. But when the quantum physicists were discovering what they were discovering, they were realizing that an observer affects the way an observation is measured. And so there cannot be that old mechanistic separation between an observer and an observed, and many other things, you know, such as wave and particle, complementarity. But the point was that that seemed to go against what Einstein was discovering about space and time. And that's been a dilemma and an issue for almost 100 years, in fact, 100 years or more. But we're now realizing from the evidence we're receiving that it's not an either or, it's a both and. So our universe exists and evolves as a non-locally unified entity. So it exists as a wholeness. And this is what the quantum physicists were realizing, that for quantum physics to work at all, our entire universe had to be inseparable at its most fundamental level. Can I just finish the thought? Because I'll go off the piece if I don't.
Let me interrupt just for me and maybe some of our audience. The term non-local has been thrown around in lots of different ways.
Yeah.
And so that people don't know what you mean by non-local. So non-local is, we're non-local right now. We're not in the same place. We're not located in the same place right now.
Indeed.
So you and I are non-local, but if there's still a way of explaining it by technology, you don't mean that kind of non-local.
No, I don't. I mean the non-locality of the nature of our universe itself. In other words, if you can think of a balloon that began to be blown up, as it were, 13.8 billion years ago, but the surface of that balloon gets bigger and bigger and bigger with every moment, then what we're realizing is that our entire universe is like that balloon. In other words, the boundary of what we call space and time is interconnected, and even more profound than that, it is essentially unified. So the whole of our universe knows itself in that wholeness throughout its whole evolutionary journey. And that's what I mean by non-local, because within space-time, there's no signaling going on because everything is fundamentally one, whole. You refer to the Judaic tradition, but many other traditions also speak of this. Yet within space-time, there is a speed limit to signaling. So when you and I are having this conversation, we hardly notice it because we're only a few thousand miles away from each other. But if you were on the moon and I was here on Earth, we'd be a quarter of a second difference, because that's the length of time it takes for a signal at the speed of light to move between. Yeah. But because, and the further away we are from each other within space-time, the longer that signal takes. So within space-time, there is an arrow of causality. You know, the past is the yesterday to today to tomorrow. There's a whole process of causality of events. Whereas for the universe as a whole, that causality is not violated within space-time, but it does enable meaningful coincidences to come together. It does enable supernormal phenomena, such as telepathy, to happen. It does enable us to have intuitive insights that are beyond the locality or the apparent locality of our physical senses. Now, this, to some of the folks watching us, listening to us, may be mind-blowing. But the reason we can say this, the reason I can share this, is because the evidence supports it, and supports it to the extent that last year in 2022, the Nobel Prize for Physics was given to three researchers, Alan Aspect, Anton Zellinger, and John Clauser. And they are researchers that have been researching the universal nature, the cosmological nature of non-locality for many, many decades. Now, the Nobel Prize in Physics, Bernard, is only given to what's known as settled science. If there's any controversy around it, if there's any, you know, thought that it might not be absolutely evidenced, the Nobel is withheld. But it was given to these three researchers so that we now consider the wholeness of our universe, its non-local unity, to be settled science. And we're finding the mathematical and physical signatures of this throughout all scales of existence. So what we're now realizing as cosmologists, but also many other scientists, is that the appearance of our universe, its space and time and energy matter, are not its fundamental nature. They're still real. Our universe is real, but its appearance of separation is illusory. And what you said about information is fundamental, because we're realizing now that it's from deeper non-physical realms of meaningful causation that our universe is meaningfully informed, literally, by digitized information, the same digitized information, the ones and zeros that we're connecting by on this call, is the universal alphabet of the entire appearance of our universe. And it means that we can tap into this. Our consciousness can tap into this. Hence synchronicities. Hence supernormal phenomena.
When you use the word meaningful,
mm-hmm.
you may know that there's a book in the 1920s called The Meaning of Meaning. Yes. And I love that title because I still wonder about the meaning of meaningfulness. And I wonder if you could tell me what you mean by meaningful.
For me, the whole universe is meaningful. A star has embedded meaning, because what we now know is that that information, that digitized information that I'm talking about, that is grounded, as it were, in non-physical realms of causation, that then emerges as the reality of our universe, does so in patterned ways and relational ways. And for me, meaning is about relationships. And so, you know, from the basis, the level of pixelation of our reality is minute. It's as small as to an atom is to entire universe. So when we come to the scale of an atom, quarks, and so protons and neutrons and electrons, they embed meaning and they embed relationship, and they are themselves fundamentally in formation. They are informed. So as we go up the scale of our universe, we move from atoms to molecules. Again, the relationships become more complex. With each level is greater than the sum of its constituent parts. There's an added complexity. So whether it's from, you know, from atoms and molecules to eventually planets and plants and people, our whole universe in its entirety expresses itself in individuated meaning. whether it's a leaf or whether it's Bernard or whether it's Jude.
Individuated meaning. Mm-hmm. I got lost because a leaf is something I could look at as itself.
Yeah.
But what you described as relation, as meaning, is relational, that meaning comes from the relationship between and among things. So where's
between
the...
and among things. So a leaf is made up of cells. Each cell of that leaf is a little meaning. I mean, cells are incredibly complex. Go down below cellular level and we get to molecular level. Each molecule embeds meaning because it tells within that molecule what it is and how it relates to other molecules. So, for example, carbon atoms combine in bonds with hydrogen and many other different chemical elements to actually ultimately form, you know, a community of cells such as us. Yeah, you know, each of us is a community of 37 trillion cells.
Yeah,
exactly. With inherent meaning at every tiny level of that. David Bohm, one of the pioneers of this sort of sense of looking at our universe as essentially a hologram. A hologram, every pixel of a hologram that is man-made or human-made, has the whole of that hologram within it. So if you take a holographic projection of, say, an apple, and you slice and dice it into a million pieces, each piece has the information of the whole. So, and this again is ancient tradition, as above, so below.
As below, so above.
Exactly.
And that's what gets missed, and you emphasize that. It goes both ways.
Goes both ways.
It's, again, a relational idea.
Yes.
One of my favorite things in the world is patterns. I think you're talking also, when you say relational and meaning, you're describing patterns of relationship. Because there are different forms of relations. And they're not all the same. They're different scales.
Exactly.
And they're also different kinds of ways that the parts of relate to each other. And what I'd ask you to comment on as we talk about this is what I call the collective human organism, mm-hmm. that the humanity is a one thing too.
Yes.
Because I think it's important to be able to help people recognize, at least as I am seeing it, that meaningful coincidences show how each of us is part of a collective human organism, the way the elements of a leaf are part of the leaf.
Absolutely, and how each leaf is part of the tree.
Yeah.
And how the tree is part of the forest, and how the forest is part of a larger, you know, ecosystem, a planetary ecosystem.
Yes.
And beyond. So what we're doing with this perception is we're scaling up from the smallest to the whole universe. But so within our collective human consciousness, we are, it's like, you know, we each of us have 37 trillion cells in our body, all of which are meaningful, all of which are informational, all of which, as you say, are in relationship and dynamic communication all the time. And as we are with each other, and the whole of our human collective consciousness.
Yes. And I'm asking for this discussion for us to stay less with the leaf and more with the parts of the leaf, metaphorically, as each of us is part of something that I'm calling the collective human organism.
Yeah.
And that we haven't realized that yet, as well as we haven't realized that we're part of Gaia, and that they're a part of nature and part of the animals and the plants that are on this planet, that it's all connected. There's meaningfulness among and between us. and meaningful coincidences show the meaning of the patterns of the relationships among and between all these elements, so that I can talk with trees, for example. Other
Yes.
people can have communications with birds or plants. And these communications are the most important part of it, not just me talking with the trees. It's the relationship that we establish that's the most important part of it. And I think that when we talk about meaning, I'm with patterns. When we talk about the nature of reality that we're both interested in from our different perspectives, it's how these patterns form and how the beautifulness of not just their staticness, but how they keep moving, and that there's a temporal, as the universe expanding, and there's always movement. There's a dynamic thing going on here. And what I'm moving towards and want to hear how you can describe is the critical variable of human ability to decide, that thing that we call free will, of which we have some degree of capacity to exercise, that I am looking at helping the collective human organism recognize that it has a collective awareness that can then make decisions that can stop or mitigate this global warming. And that's taking some of what you are saying and organizing it in what to me is a pragmatic way of saying, we got to organize here, or recognize that we are organized, and recognize what you keep using words that's a recognize, kind of like see again what we already know, that we're all part of something, as ancient wisdom traditions have tried to tell us. I want to be able to get that to happen. And synchronicity is a way to have that happen, to see the patterns of interrelationships. So if I could get you away from the cosmological view and get us to not a leaf, but humanity.
Sure,
and
of course.
What we have to do here is, yeah. I think what you're doing anyway. So would you please comment on whatever I'm trying to ask you?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. But I think there's one more thing that's really key in all of this.
Go ahead.
All these relational communications are dynamic, and they're also evolutionary, because the whole of our universe's story is one of meaningful existence and purposeful evolution. So the wholeness of our universe over that vast amount of time has gone from its very, you know, its initial incredible simplicity to ever greater levels of complexity. And awareness, individuated awareness of that interconnection, interdependence, interbeingness, that we're continuing that story in our own perspectives, in our own awareness, both individually and collectively. Now, the other thing to say at this moment is that underlying the appearance of our universe, its space and time and energy matter, are these non-physical, what's called attractor basins. And these are attractors of information. So we find these underpinning all the patterns that you talk about. So the same underlying attractor underpins a biological ecosystem and the internet. The same underlying attractor underpins our collective behaviors and phenomena such as earthquakes. And for us, our collective consciousness is an attractor that, depending on the collective level of awareness, behaves in different ways. So if our underlying level of awareness is a worldview, is a perception, a separation, then we will act accordingly. And all all the existential issues that we are faced with, whether it's climate change, loss of biodiversity, pollution, conflicts, are all natural behaviors arising from that essential collective level of consciousness. Now, when a complex system has come to a particular point in its evolution, and its underlying attractor, think of it like a bowl, and think of our collective consciousness or the collective information of any complex system coming to a point where it becomes unstable. Yeah, it's affected by something beyond its own boundary or within itself. It becomes unstable. It starts to break down. It cannot hold any coherence. What has happened over 13.8 billion years of evolution, and especially the evolution on our planetary home, is that as that's broken down in that non-physical realm of information, a higher level attractor has formed. This is what's driven biological evolution. And that higher level attractor is more complex and essentially more coherent than its predecessor. So what happens is the old is breaking down and the new is beginning to potentize. Yeah. And yeah, something called flickering happens. What happens in flickering is the old, as it breaks down, sort of tries to jump to the new, which is coming forward. When enough of that old attractor is able to jump to that new attractor then fully manifests. And that is evolution. So for us, the more of us that wake up to remember we're inseparable, the more these chinks open up, this understanding of wholeness and unity and diversity, because unity is not uniformity, the more we are co-creating this higher level attractor basin of consciousness.
Yeah, and attractor is, for me, another word of belief about how things are. The belief that we're separate is what's breaking down, and the belief that we are part of the same thing is what's emerging.
So, and yet, it's evidence-based. This is, for me, this is the game changer. This goes beyond a belief. If we have any agreement in terms of consensus reality, yes, that the sun rises in the morning and sets at night, or it doesn't actually, because we're the ones who are turning.
That's right.
But nonetheless, you know, we can speak of that together, and everyone on planet Earth can speak of that together. This is consensus reality, and this is why I'm writing the books I'm writing, because I want to share the evidence for this. And now cosmologists, but also many, many scientists across many fields of research are coming to this same perception. And it's a perception where, because mind and consciousness aren't something we have, but literally what we and the whole world are, we are empowered by this worldview. This is a worldview that encompasses synchronicities, that invites us to realize and expand our awareness in this way. I would see it as an invitation by the universe to wake up and evolve consciously to become co-evolutionary partners with our planetary home. And that's really vital, because as we do, we can heal our relationship with our planetary home, Gaia, and all her children. We can come into that engagement and communication and relationship, as you said, with the trees, with the animals, with the rocks. You know, Indigenous people see that sentience, that web of life, not just in biological organisms, but
how do meaningful coincidences play a role in what you just described?
For me, they reveal that the nature of reality is innately meaningful. Because for me, we use the word random. We've had an evolutionary biology that says it's driven by random mutations. It categorically is not. You know, our biological organisms go to incredible levels of effort and energy to reduce the level of random mutations to an absolute bare minimum, because almost always they are detrimental. Instead, what the whole of biological evolution does is it embodies meaningful information as templates for the coherence of biological organisms and their relationships with the rest of our planetary home, what I call the geosphere, the minerals and rocks of her geosphere, the waters of her hydrosphere, the atmosphere, as well as the biosphere. It's in its entirety.
And the technosphere.
And the technosphere itself is you know, a human, you know, a human invented way of co-creating connections. And yet we don't need the technosphere. It's almost like a step to this newer sphere, this step to us realizing our natural attributes, our natural understanding. Yeah.
It's a step. It's a metaphor for what we can do without it.
Exactly so.
So please talk a little bit more about how meaningful coincidences are part of all this.
Well, it's rather like in both meaningful coincidences, Bernard, you also mentioned intuition. You know, for me, our intuition is our superpower. And you know, when we hear our intuition and listen to it, in other words, act on it, in my experience, it's the whole universe inviting us into this remembered wholeness where we are its microcosmic co-creators. Yeah. And if we're living in a world of perceived materialism and separation, we don't hear those. We don't listen to those intuitive callings, those nudges. We don't see a synchronicity as being meaningful. And so we go on with this fragmented perception of the nature of reality. So for me, they open the curtains, they open the chink.
And let me describe how I think they open the curtains. Mm-hmm. Because a major form of meaningful coincidence is some event in my mind matches an event in my environment, mind, object. And when that happens, that's an embodiment of the experience of our connectedness with what's around us.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's, you know, that's, I've had the great, great joy of living my life in this way since I was a very little girl, walking between worlds and really sort of, you know, understanding, sensing this. So I would have loved to have written these books and been educated in this way when I was 6, 7, 8 years old.
Well, that's what we're doing. I'm reaching out to Gen Z people now, they are ready for just what we each would have wanted when we were growing up.
Exactly. And I'm doing the same thing. I'm part of a group who drafted what we call a unitive narrative of unity and diversity based on this, you know, underpinned and framed by this evidence, to then serve unitive education. Unitive economics, unitive justice, unitive anything with a unitive in front of it, because this affects everything, all our choices and all our behaviors.
When we realize we're all part of this thing, then it will affect how we decide.
Exactly.
And in part of your unitive education, where is meaningful coincidence?
Right in the middle of that, because it's an experiential education.
Yeah.
It's not just understanding all that we've been exploring today. It's experiencing, you know, what intuition, what joy, what aha moments, intuitions and synchronicities can offer us every time say, we're one, we're unity and diversity. And just to feel this, I don't know about you, but the great, for me, this tells us we belong. It's more than unity and diversity. It says we belong with each other, with our planetary home, with the whole world. This is a science of love. This is a science of love.
It's love. And love comes in so many different forms, but it has to do with connection in various different ways. We have different names for it. But there's such a good feeling of many meaningful coincidences is that feeling of being connected with something that we're a little surprised to be connected with. And yet there we know we've had the experience of them. So for me, I'm glad you say it, the central part is the experience, the embodiment of the connection, because we have these bodies here, which are very smart in their ways. That there's a lot to learn from our body speak.
Yes.
And what I'm trying to do that fits in with what you're trying to do, what you are doing, is being able to embody the unified experience so that we feel it, not just know it. And meaningful coincidences are a great way of being able to help people do that.
I love that. And you know, when we do experience and embody that in our own lives, we can link up and lift up with others who are also experiencing it. You know, we can invite everyone into this great adventure of our conscious evolution.
And so the Coincidence Project, which I founded and am president of, has created something we call the Coincidence Cafe, which is a Zoom meeting once a month on Saturdays at 11 a.m. Eastern time, where people get together and tell each other coincidence stories.
Fabulous.
And when they do that, they find sometimes coincidences among and between them, which is always a lot of fun when that happens. So the idea of having this embodiment take place can be facilitated by encouraging people to tell each other their coincidence stories.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
That's what the Coincidence Project's main aim is to do, is to help people tell each other their coincidence stories, to embody the unity of which we are all a part.
I love that. It must be a fantastic opportunity every month to just get together. And, you know, we are a story sharing, storytelling species. So I think sharing our stories, especially in that way, is so wonderfully supportive and empowering.
Stories and patterns. That's
yep,
basic
that's
human.
That's the one. They're the ones. Yeah.
That's basic human. So next 2 weeks, I'm starting one in person here in Charlottesville with people who are very dedicated to understanding meaningful coincidence and experiencing them.
Brilliant.
And what I want to be able to see is that, like, I mean, the big breath and all its energy and information in it is a metaphor for what I'm trying to do here, create a little nucleus of intense enthusiasm and passion for meaningful connections through meaningful coincidences, and have this thing expand very much like you have described the universe has expanded into the consciousness of humanity.
Yes.
That's my aim.
Yes. And I absolutely wholeheartedly agree with you. You know, it's so intimate and yet it's so universal.
Expansive. Yeah.
And you know, so when people do so, and they can go get those aha moments. And I'm sure for you and myself, certainly, and for many, many other folks, it just invites us into this incredible adventure and curiosity of ongoing discovery.
Yes. Yes, it invites us into this adventure of ongoing curiosity. But you know what it requires in all this? And we're having to come to the end of our time together, but curiosity, you mentioned curiosity. You and I have been curiouser and curiouser, said Alice in Alice in Wonderland. It gets curiouser and curiouser wandering around this wonderland of Earth and Gaia and the universe. It gets curiouser and curiouser. You keep wanting to know more about how it works. And that it's so much fun to be able
it's
to
so
do it.
Fun.
However, as you well know, it takes some work to organize things to make this stuff happen. So organizing these groups has been a big effort for me, because I like to think about things and experience them. But to organize is another aspect of myself, which I can do. I've been a leader a lot of times, but it's still work. And expansion and contraction thing that is part of breathing, that is part of life, that is part of my favorite, one of my favorite things is a sine wave. It's just this, it's this sine wave is so fundamental to how reality works. And that has to bright breathing and black and white and up and down and all those things are right there. So you have to do the technology, the work, the administration to get the expansion, to get to more administration, to get to more expansion. You know that one. And sure. I know that one. It's you can't just sail off into, which some people do, it's called spiritual bypassing. They get too far out and they don't bring it down here. It's so important. What you're doing is so important to the future of humanity. Now, you have a lot more confidence than I do. I can tell because you believe in the evolution and coevolution potential, and the attractors are happening, and there's a lot of good stuff happening. But I believe that some of us have to keep working, as you have to do with your book and your next book coming out, to help embody all this experience. That we have to help people, other people, do the work that allows this new paradigm to become experiential. And you're doing it in your way, I'm doing it my way. It's wonderfully synergistic. And I so deeply respect what you're doing, what you're thinking, and what's coming through you, because it isn't just you, and just where that's coming from is fun to think about. And it's another topic for another subject, another time, but it is coming through us. But you know something? The funny thing is, for you, I can tell, I have it too, is we've got to do what we're doing here. There is almost a compulsion. Some people call it passion.
It's passion. I really do feel, though, I always remember when I was growing up, and I could get so quite full of, oh, I must do this, must do. And my mum always used to say, get over yourself. So what I try my best to do is to show up, but get out of the way. You know, just get out of my own way on this. And just,
well, you have a little different way of doing it. I prefer not to have to show up and just kind of think about my stuff and do things. But then when I do that, when I get my rest, when I'm rested and I'm feeling good, I'm back running around trying to do this. I'll call it work, but it's really more fun. It's fun work. A life purpose, and you've got it. I've got it. I'm so glad to be able to talk with you, and having looked at your book and read some of what's in there. Jude, you have coming through you a wonderful mind. I'm going to attribute some of it to you and that coal mining experience back then, because you got grounded and your mind is in outer space. And it's very important to have the feet on the ground and have your head in outer space and be able to be grounded while you're imagining and running around figuring out stuff, and being able to say it to people. And you are that, grounded and way out there at the same time.
Thank you, Bernard. It's funny you're saying that. That's very kind of you. Thank you. We, at Whole World View, we talk about act local, feel global, and think cosmic.
Oh, that's better. Okay. That's better.
So it's very intimate. It's very embodied and experienced. And yet we have the whole universe.
Just repeat that, and we're going to stop in a minute, but I'd like to be able to end with that mantra you just...
Okay. Act local, feel global, and think cosmic.
Thank you, Jude Gervin. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for talking with me today.
It's my great pleasure, Bernard. Thank you.
The psychosphere is our mental atmosphere, like a hologram of cosmic consciousness.